right here with honor today. A warrior, a queen with my sword by my side. I can't remember the names of these men as they cover.
That was the Warrior Queen, and that was Alliandra, I believe that's the way you pronounce it. Moon Goddess is another term that is applied to this singer. And this is Freya's Day, Friday, and that's an appropriate song. We'll dedicate that to Kathy Ainsworth, okay? All right, we're at P.O. Box 401, as usual, on guard and ready to go. Yeah, P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And it is time to get your donations in for the show, and they're coming in. Yeah, we're getting them, little by little. Yeah. Don't forget to go up to resist.com. We keep putting up new things up there, you know. Go to resist.com and search around. You can get a racial education on that website. I don't think there's any website any better with more important information than that website. If you download the figures on the amount of contacts it's made and all of that each month, you'll see that there's a hell of a lot of people go to resist.com. And today is the 8th month, the 7th day, Friday, Freya's Day. We've got a half moon out there now, half moon. We got our Friday nighter tonight downtown. Everybody comes downtown, they walk around, they got their dogs and they got their cars and they got hot rods and they got things to eat and everything. It's sort of like an old country fair type thing. Every month they do that on a Friday, on Freya's Day. And the farmers markets are all out there too. They've been going. We got a couple of farmers markets going big and strong. You can buy about anything you want and get something good quality. Not like those New York Jews used to sell down in the poor districts of New York City. And now even in some of the high-priced grocery stores you can get crap. Well, they had the big debate last night. I missed it for some reason. My TV hookup, for some reason, I didn't get it. I figured CNN would cover it, but my CNN didn't cover it. But I understand it wasn't that much to write home about anyhow. And like I told a lot of the guys, I said, look, the first candidate that says the word white in a positive way, or white people or white working class, there we got somebody to vote for. Otherwise, forget it. Forget it. They talk about African Americans and Jews and the American Mongols and all that, but they don't want to talk about white working class Americans. None of them. Not one of them. And if one does, you let me know. Well, I've been jumping into the pool lately. I was encouraged to go to the YMCA and use their beautiful pool system here. We have a big new YMCA here. But it's very depressing because two pools, and one's full of big, fat, overweight, white women all the time. And the other one's partially full, so I have to go to one end of the pool to do my exercises. And it's really depressing to look around at these women that are 200-300 pounds and they're so big they can't even swim. That's what's happening to our race. You know, these warmongers want a war. None of these people could survive any war because they're so totally, totally unfit. And every time I go there, it just depresses me, I'll tell you that. Because I told the lifeguard, a young guy there, a young Aryan guy, I say, you know, this state of Indiana is sinking into the fat. The fat is sinking the whole state. And he smiled and he said, you're right there, you're right there. I said, if one of these big fat mamas go to the bottom of the pool and you're only weighing, look like about 150 pounds, how are you going to get her out? And he said, well, if I didn't have this super flotation device, I couldn't. There'd be no way I could save them. But they have these new flotation devices that are almost impossible to push under the water. So anyhow, enough of that. But I'll tell you, I feel good, and I think I'm improving. And, of course, I know that I've lost weight and so forth. But I wasn't fat before, but there's always a little fat you can lose. I'm aiming at my high school weight and muscular makeup. That's what I'm aiming at. May not make it, but we're going to give it a go. Yesterday we got started on another book, and I'll alternate now and then every few days from one to the other. Oh, wait a minute. I forgot A Pessimist's Guide to History. We got to do that first. Let's see what happened way back when. Let's see here. 490 B.C., the Battle of Marathon, from their vantage point on a hill overlooking the plain of Marathon, and that's not a gas station, that's a place. 10 Athenian generals surveyed the massive Persian army threatening Athens, which was located just 22 miles away. Some 100,000 Persian troops stood in vast formations on the plain, not far from the shore where the 600 galleys that had brought the invaders to Greece lay in anchor. The Persians' reputation for being invincible no doubt gave the generals pause for thought. Yeah, our generals better think about that too while they're screwing with Iran, Persia. Those guys are not pushovers. Saddam Hussein found that out. The fact that Persian soldiers outnumbered the Greeks 10 to 1 would have convinced any reasonable tactician that it was time to withdraw to fight another day. The Persians had launched their invasion of Greece to avenge the Athenians' burning of a Persian city 9 years before. Well, that makes sense. Some 1,000 Placians joined the 10,000 Athenians, who now commanded strong defensive positions in the hills between the Persian force and Athens. Sparta also promised to send troops to help fight the Persian invaders, but Spartans' religious observances prohibited the marshaling of troops except during the full moon, so the 11,000 Greeks were faced with the terrible choice of how best to defend Greece: to attack the far superior Persian force or to remain in defensive positions. Well, if you hadn't burned down the Persian city, you wouldn't be worrying about it, right? The Athenian generals split evenly on the question. Some generals denounced the attack as suicidal folly. It remained for overall commander Callimachus to cast the tie-breaking vote. The general Miltiades said to him, quote, "It now rests with you either to enslave Athens or by assuring her freedom to win yourself immortality of fame," unquote. Callimachus voted to attack. Then came word that the much dreaded Persian cavalry had disappeared from the plain, leaving the main body vulnerable to attack. At dawn on September 21st, 10,000 Greeks charged down the hillside on foot, a sight that the Persians watched with stunning unbelief. The historian Herodotus wrote that the Persians thought them a set of madmen rushing upon certain destruction, unquote. He called the Athenians the first Greeks of whom I have heard who ever beheld without dismay the garb and armor of the Medes, for hitherto the very name of Mede excited terror. The Athenians had the advantage of the attack, and their bronze breastplates actually gave them better protection than the Persian army. But what the Persians could not know was that the Athenians had deliberately put more men on the left and right flanks than on the line now charging the Persians. The Persian center held against the weaker Greek forces, but the Persian flanks collapsed as the Athenian charge drove forward in furious hand-to-hand combat. Something you're going to have to relearn, white boy. Suddenly, the Persians found themselves being enveloped by the smaller Greek force and had no choice but to flee to their ships. The Athenians pressed their attack, hacking away at the disorganized Persians and attacking the galleys as they prepared to flee. Though the Athenian leader Callimachus died in the battle, the Athenians had delivered a smashing blow to the superior Persian force. The plain of Marathon was strewn with bodies of about 6,400 Persians, while only 192 Greeks had died. Athenian general Miltiades knew the war was not yet over, however. Realizing the Persians would probably try to attack Athens again, he led an all-night march back to Athens just in time to meet the Persian fleet as it had arrived. On seeking the Greek army already in position, the Persian fleet turned back and sailed away, went home. Interesting story. Interesting story. Next time, tomorrow, we'll cover the 464 BC Spartan earthquake. Yeah. Now back to the Sheenies. Pretty forcible, but upon the whole a very accurate description of the true state of affairs. Yet another reason why the hotel keeper excludes the Jew is the latter's personal uncleanliness. The Jews as a race are undoubtedly the dirtiest people. Wait a minute. On the face of the earth. They seem to have a profound aversion to soap and cold water and to the maxim that cleanliness is next to godliness. All the many rules laid down for their guidance in this connection in Holy Writ seem to have gone for naught. even the ears of the wealthiest Jewesses, laden down as they may be with gigantic diamond solitaires, you will often see great deposits of dirt nestling in the lobes of the ears. The men and the women alike are so subject to body lice that it is not safe to occupy a bed in which they have slept, or even to bathe on the same seashore as that upon which they have disported. Last season, a certain millionaire manufacturer of New York, a representative businessman and a prince of a good fellows, whose name is known from Maine to California, went down to the West End at Long Branch, taking with him his family, his grooms, his fast trotters, and all the paraphernalia of a swell establishment. Having established himself comfortably in one of the finest cottages at the West End, he set about enjoying himself, one of his favorite forms of amusement being to go in bathing. It so happened that a short distance to the north of him was a cottage which was used as a Jew boarding house, and there Israel was gathered in force. The weather was very warm, and garbed in heavy bathing dresses of outlandish pattern, the Jews used to go into bathing at times when the Christian manufacturer was in the water. The manufacturer had not been at the branch many days when he found himself afflicted with a most peculiar and violent itching in various parts of his body. He washed and scratched, and still he continued to itch with increased intensity. At last, when he was almost worked himself into a state of nervous collapse, he came to the conclusion that he must be suffering from some strange skin malady, and he hurried off to a doctor. The doctor looked him over and laughed. "My dear Mr. Blank," he said, "you're suffering from body lice. Let me see. You're staying at the Blank Cottage, and near you is that Jewish boarding house. You have caught these little infections while bathing in the water at the same time as they. I have known of similar cases here before. Remember, whenever these Jews are around, to look for lice in every air." Within 24 hours later, the snug cottage by the sea was dismantled. The swell establishment was broken up, and the fast trotters and the grooms and their millionaire masters were speeding away from the branch. They were fleeing from the Jews as one flees from a pestilence. Can it be wondered at that? The summer hotel keeper sternly waves the Jew away and refuses to take him within his doors. The Jew in Wall Street. The evil done by the Jews does not come from individuals, but from the very constitution of the people. Quote, Napoleon First. Let us turn to Wall Street and look at the Jew there, in the feverish atmosphere of the street, with its mad excitements, its wild speculations, its covetous corners, greedy combinations, and tricky booms, with its manifold opportunities for double-dealing, treachery, wholesale despoiling, rascality, misrepresentation, and deceit, the Jew feels happy and thoroughly at home. The two leading lusts of the Jew's life are lechery and money. In Wall Street, men think of nothing, care of nothing, talk of nothing but money. And in this atmosphere, which rings with the perpetual cry of money, 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 the Jew revels with all the intoxicated rapture of a voluntary plunging into the cars into some licentious debauchery. And as he plots and plans and intrigues and cheats amid the hoarse roar of the money-making and the crash of the crumbling fortunes, he feels that he is following out the true bent of his nature. He is truly happy. The street is the Jew's paradise. When close upon a century ago, 25 brokers met under the shade of the buttonwood tree, standing opposite what is now number 60 Wall Street, and signed a joint agreement which practically laid the foundation of that vast institution today known as the New York Stock Exchange, there was among the signatures not a single Jew name. Decades rolled by, the Stock Exchange grew into a mighty institution, gaining steadily in influence and importance, and its membership was year after year jealously kept free from the defiling contamination of Israel. It was not until about 15 years ago that the hosts of Judah began to gird up their loins and prepare for the combined assault upon the stock exchange. They had hard work for a time, but at last they succeeded in forcing their way in and securing a foothold. This foothold once secured, the Hebrews came pouring in constantly increasing numbers, so that during the past 10 years, fully 40% of the new members have been Jews. The New York Stock Exchange has today a membership of 1,100, of which fully 10% is composed of Jews. Of the 2,000 members of the Consolidated Exchange, some 250 are Jews. It was not, and see, this was at the beginning of the 19th century. It was not long after the Jews had forced their way into the stock exchange before their presence rendered necessary the passing of a rule which is to this day in force. The English only must be spoken on the floor of the exchange. The cause? And it aptly illustrates the clannishness of the Jews, which immediately led to the passage of this rule, was as follows. One day, about 10 years ago, a Jew member of the exchange sold a block of stock to a Gentile broker. Just as the sale was effected, another Jew said something in German to the seller, to the effect that he wanted to purchase the stock. Instantly, the first Jew declared the sale off, with the all-too-evident purpose of favoring the other descendant of the tribes. The Gentile broker declared that he could not thus favor one member at the expense of another, that it was against the rules of the exchange. Thereupon, the first Jew unblushingly asserted that he had made no sale to the Jew number two, that no sale at all had in fact been effected. The Gentile broker, feeling he was being defrauded of his rights, made a complaint, and the very neat trap was set for the detection of the Jew conspirators. It is a custom in the street, Wall Street, to send a messenger around to various offices after business has closed to verify purchases or sales. A messenger who purported to come from Jew 2 was sent to the office of number of Jew 1 to verify the suspected sale of the block of stock in question. To the messenger, the sale of the stock was admitted at Jew number 1's office, thus making out a clear case against him. Thereupon, the authorities of the stock exchange suspended both Jew offenders, ordering that the sale to the Gentile broker go into effect, and passed the order referred to, directing that, in the future, English only must be spoken on the floor of the exchange. A mere straw, indeed, to oppose the tide of Jew duplicity and treachery. Every child throughout the length and breadth of the land knows of that great salient figure in Wall Street, of the man who, by dint of accumulated millions, practically rules the market and sways values at will. The evil genius of the street, the modern corsair, the land pirate who wrecks vast railroad and telegraph system as the hangers of false beacon lights wrecking ships on in olden time in order to profit from their disintegration, the trickster to whom no promise or agreement is sacred, and who never yet entered a deal without betraying or selling out his confederates, the wizard who began as an inventor of mousetraps and developed into a trapper of men, the man whose name stands as the incarnation of fraud and chicanery and deceit. Not the least mysterious peculiarity of this very mysterious personage is his origin. His parents were not Jews. It has not been found possible to trace any Jew blood among his ancestors. He himself denies that he has any Jewish blood in his veins. But however this may be, account for it as you will, certain it is that the evil genius of the street has Jew blood in his veins, is out and out a Jew. The Jews on their side are proud of him, and plainly recognizing him a brother, secretly rejoicing in him, and count him as one of their own race. It may thus be safely relied upon that the greatest rascal of the age bears the stamp of Israel upon his face, and is however difficult it may be to trace his origin, a Jew. Among the leading Jews in the street is a banker who represents the greatest of all European Jew banking houses, and of one of those whose members he is said to be a natural son. He is a short, swarthy, hard-featured little man, who is chiefly remarkable for his outrageous assumption of airs of importance and extravagant dignity. Again and again has this miserable little Jew with the bar sinister across his escutcheon, this descendant of the rabble which howled around Calvary 19 centuries ago, insulted with the pompous mien and blatant arrogance of honest Aryan folk with whom he has been brought in contact. He is an admirable sample of the proud Jew, of the Jew in high place, of the Jew insolent in his wealth and puffed up with self-sufficiency and self-importance, an excellent exemplification of the proverbial beggar on horseback. Yet with all his pride and with all his arrogance, with all his self-importance, he, like his brethren of the ghetto and of Baxter Street, is physically dirty. He cannot keep his ears clean. Next and important amongst the Jews in the street are two brothers who are also in the banking business, who affect great airs of social distinction. They originally kept a clothing store on Baxter Street, basis in the upper part of the state, and later were in business in San Francisco. Their fortune was accumulated in army contracts during the war, and it was not until after the collapse of the rebellion that they branched out in New York. Remember, Ulysses S. Grant was stationed first in the South in Mississippi and for quite some time, and then he was moved to San Francisco, in which place he came in contact with the big and powerful Jews of San Francisco. He was their boy, and that's what it says there. Their fortune was accumulated in army contracts during the Civil War, and it was not until after the collapse of the rebellion that they branched out in New York. Little things pop up here and there. For many years, they contrived to disguise themselves as honest men, but recently their true character was plainly disclosed in connection with the floating of bonds of a certain railroad. After the bonds had been placed by these Jew bankers, just one solitary quarterly coupon was paid, after which the whole enterprise collapsed, and the road had to be put into the hands of the Aryans for thorough reorganization. Investigation disclosed the most disgraceful state of affairs. At last, the eyes of the public were opened to the true character of this respectable Jew banking house, and today the Jew bankers, ruined in reputation, recognized far and wide as barefaced swindlers, could not float an enterprise involving the investment of $100. The two brothers have each a goodly brood of young olive branches. Most of them are distinguished by their peculiar Jewish lechery, their abandoned armors, their profligate modes of life. A few years ago, there was a young Jew in the street, Wall Street, who during the boom of 78 and 80, by cunning speculations and accumulated a large fortune. He determined to retire and go to Europe with his Gentile mistress, his Aryan mistress, and there to sport himself after ostensive fashion so dear to the Jew heart. He secured by an act of the legislature the changing of his Israelitish cognomen to a name borne by an eminent American family, married his Aryan mistress, and then set sail for Europe. He established himself in London, taking fashionable residence in the West End, and assiduously cultivated the acquaintance of the American minister. He managed so cleverly that the official seat in the Jew's name for the presentation at court, but the Lord Chamberlain scented the Jew from afar, and investigation ensued. And as a result of this investigation, the ambitious Jew's metaphorist name was promptly eliminated from the presentation list. Prominent among the Jews in the street, Wall Street, are two brothers who, by their ridiculous antics and strange habits, and generally Jewish characteristics are unfailing sources of merriment, standing butts of ridicule. The one is tall, lank, and blonde, with large round gold spectacles and a lost expression on his face. The other is short, stout, chunky, with a general appearance suggestive of a retired prize fighter who has gone to seed. He has a fussy habit of rudely elbowing his way wherever he goes. He wears marvelous collars which stretch high up on his about his ears, and upon his head is a little round cap such as tourists or monkeys carry. He usually carries a half-consumed cigar in his mouth, and as he talks with you, he will industriously scrub his teeth with the ashy end. Observing a look of disgust upon your face, he will explain, "What? You think that's dirty? Bah, mine friend, der cigar ash is der finest dentifrice in the world." These brothers originally came from California, where they kept a cheap John clothing shop, while their sister maintained a hotel where the accommodations were extended to ladies and gentlemen without an over-rigid scrutiny into the nature of their relationship or their possession of a marriage certificate. These Jews, as it usually is the case with the tribes, flaunt their wealth with lavish ostentation. This is especially the case of the elder brother of the brothers, the one with the peculiar habit as to applying cigar ashes to his teeth. His wife appears at the opera or in the boxes of leading theaters fairly ablaze with diamonds. A curious story is told in connection with two of the solitaires worn by her. Her spouse was in the habit of sporting two enormous headlights in the bosom of his shirt. One day he appeared in the street, Wall Street, without these adornments. He was stopped before long by an acquaintance who exclaimed, "Hello, what have you done with your diamonds?" "Well," exclaimed the Jew, with perfect innocence and great good nature, "I find that only gamblers and women of color wear diamonds, so I give them to my wife." This story got abroad and was extensively paragraphed in the newspapers throughout the country. It was this Jew who originated it. Another interesting little domestic episode is recounted as having taken place between this interesting pair of Hebrews in High Life. Upon one occasion, it is said that the husband came home and, in a high good humor over some lucky financial strokes, exclaimed, "Get on your things, Betsy, we go out together." "But where are we going?" inquired his wife. "Never you mind, you find out that when we get there." "Oh, very well," responded wife. "But you tell me, mine husband, shall I wash for a high neck or a low neck dress?" Both these brothers are, you know, it takes a while to turn these pages. It's an old book and the pages are pretty frail. Both these brothers are, as will already have been perceived, remarkable in spite of their great financial success for their lack of brightness and great intellectual stupidity. Their great obtuseness in ordinary intercourse constantly suggests them to ridicule. A story which is well known in the Wall Street aptly illustrates the point. The tall brother with the gold spectacles and the lost expression was one day standing on the floor of the exchange in the midst of a group of brokers who were laughing and chatting together and carrying on in that frisky fashion peculiar to members of the exchange when business is slack. It was a particularly dull day. And presently, the young broker, noted for his bright witticisms, remarked, "Things are so dull on the change today that even if a coon came in, he couldn't make a cent." A roar of laughter greeted this sally, in which the respectable Jew joined in a feeble way. That evening, he found himself in the company uptown, and in the course of the conversation, he remarked that young Blank had got off a good thing on the floor of the exchange that afternoon. "What did he say?" several eagerly inquired. "Well," responded the Jew, beaming through his gold-rimmed spectacles and glowing with pleasure, pride at thus attracting attention to himself. "He said that things were so dull on the change today that even if a coon came in, he couldn't make a dollar." To this day, the Jew has not discovered how it was that Blank's story, which was so well received on the floor of the exchange, fell so utterly flat before the uptown party. The stinginess and general meanness of this dullard Jew actually surpassed belief. It is a favorite trick with him when on a horse car in which he perceives an acquaintance to affect to have forgotten his pocketbook or to have only bills of large denomination upon his person. On the strength of this excuse, he will borrow some small change, and borrowing of which he invariably forgets, or rather affects to forget. Even by any chance, it is returned. These petty loans are sometimes made from some clerk in the street on a small salary. Nobody's too insignificant for this niggard Jew to borrow from. Imagine this wretch, the possessor of millions, thus filching from some poor toiler with nothing in the world beyond a week's salary he carries in his pocket, and then going on his way chuckling and rejoicing in his Jew heart that is some few stolen pennies the richer. And now, to give an instance of the Jew brutal attack of all fine feeling and delicacy. One day a gentleman called at the office of these Jew brothers and had an interview with the elder one as a matter of business. Presently, in the course of the conversation, the Jew exclaimed to his visitor, "Ah, I see of us in mourning. Who for? For my little boy whom I have just lost." "What? Not that bright little fellow who was with you last time you came to the office?" "Yes, for him." "Ach, too bad, too bad." "How very sudden." "Yes, very sudden." "Well, you surprise me. It is very shocking, very shocking. Hello, excuse me," suddenly putting a dirty thumb and forefinger to his visitor's scarf, "but that was a fine diamond you have there. Is that a real stone?" Every day during a portion of the lunch hour, the younger of the brothers is in the habit of strutting up and down in front of the office with ostentatious mien and provoking self-satisfied air. One day, a gentleman who had long been watching the Jew's lordly and majestic strut, and who felt irresistibly impelled to give some vent to this disgust, stepped up to the inflated Israelite and with a sweeping bow blandly said, "Will you excuse me, sir, but I am a stranger in these parts, and I would like to ask you a question. I have for some time past been observing you as you walk up and down, and I would like to inquire, if you will permit me, who you are." "I, sir," said the Jew, swelling in self-importance and entirely oblivious to the latent sarcasm in the speaker's words, "I, sir, am blankety-blank." "Indeed, ah, indeed," rejoined the other. "So you are blankety-blank, huh? Dear me, what a mistake I came near making. I took you to be the President of the United States." Just as the other two brothers, who are bankers in Wall Street, lost their prestige through roguery, so this precious pair recently came into the disrepute through the rascally conduct of one of the members of their house. The younger brother had a son who held a confidential position in the firm and was acquainted with its secrets. Upon one occasion, the brothers entered into a pool with a number of speculators in the street, Wall Street, to boom a certain stock. The son thereupon went over the Wall Street and sold the secrets of the combine on all sides, the understanding being that he was to receive a share of the profits derived. As a natural result, the pool found that all its preparations were handicapped, and a general collapse ensued. The treachery of the young Jew was promptly discovered and fully proven, and the members of the pool demanded that the Jew firm make restitution to them of the losses they had suffered by the young scoundrel's dishonesty. Needless to say that this appeal to the firm's honor was simply breath wasted. A Jew honor? As well might one speak of a harlot's chastity. Until a few years ago, there was a good deal of money lending going on the Wall Street. It was all done by the Jews, who shamelessly violated what is known as the usury law and charged as high as an eighth and even a quarter percent per day. Research will show that all the railroads, all the public schemes, all the enterprises of which the Jews have had the handling and secured control have sooner or later come to grief under more or less shady circumstances. But always, of course, with a profit for the Jew, who fattens upon disintegration and ruin. That's why they love war. Like my grandma used to say, war is Jew harvest. As the carrion crow fattens on the festering corpses of the battlefield, it is a singular fact that in the few years since the Jews have obtained a foothold in the stock exchange and on the Wall Street, in Wall Street, have been slowly but steadily and surely going to the bad. There is no disguising the fact that today business in the Wall Street is an alarming condition of stagnation, and that most of the brokers are what they, in their expressive language, term hard up. I remember my father using that term a lot, hard up. This condition of affairs is due to lack of public confidence, leading to a general unwillingness to invest. The growth of the public sentiment is mostly entirely attributable to the lack of good faith and honest dealing evidenced in the recent years and the sharp practices, to put it mildly, so extensively resorted to. And who is more greatly responsible for the rascality and roguery practiced than the Jews today in Wall Street? As matters now stand, it looks very much as if the street would have to wait for good times until a new generation of speculators shall have sprung up. Perhaps, however, good times might be brought back, a general boom effected, and public confidence to a certain degree restored by a general expulsion of Jews from Wall Street. The Jew in the tobacco trade. What have these usurers let escape their grasp? The original Mr. Jacobs. The tobacco and cigar trade has passed almost entirely into the hands of the Jews and the exportation of cancer. It is safe to assert that 90% of the capital at present invested in trade is Jew capital. You know, it's interesting that here while the Jews were up to their neck in the tobacco industry, but under Adolf Hitler in Germany, the scientists had discovered the link between tobacco and cancer. And they had all the research papers and everything, and of course that's why Hitler didn't allow people to smoke around him. But they didn't make it a dictatorship type situation. People did smoke in the Third Reich. But what happened at the end of the war, the British swept in, British military, and swept up all these scientific research papers, and among them was the research papers that belled the cat on tobacco and cancer, and took them back to England and locked them up in probably the Tower of England, Tower of London, and never released them. So from 1945 at least till near the present day, people were not actually straight on informed that tobacco caused cancer, and it was known all the way back there under National Socialism. Like every other industry in which the hook nose of Israel has obtruded itself, the tobacco and cigar trade suffers from the Jews' connection with it. The Jew in the tobacco trade figures throughout, as is invariably the case, a jobber, a trader, a speculator, and profiter in the labor of others, but as a producer, never. Of course, you know, they were involved in the cotton trade a lot, too, and they were trading cotton back and forth across military lines in the Civil War, not caring who they were helping or hurting, just to make the profit. The men who raise the tender, pleasure-yielding plant are Gentiles, or Arians. The laborers who gather it and bind it into bales for the market are Arians. The workmen and work girls who strip, roll, and pack are Arians. It is only when it becomes comes to jobbing, selling, and manufacturing that the Jew figures prominently in the trade. Then he comes out in a full force. In the tobacco trade, as in other branches of industry, the Jew resorts to his favorite trick of going into the alleged bankruptcy and therefore making a haul at the expense of his ill-starred creditors, which reminds me of a story of a friend of mine in California who was getting on in years, and he had been in the mattress business in L.A. And he said, "Tom, this is the way it worked. These Jews will open up on one side of the street trying to drive you out of business. They fill these mattresses with sawdust, cigarette butts, or anything they can cram into them. Totally bad mattresses. They sell them cheap on sale and screw everybody. And then when the everything's discovered, they go to bankruptcy. And what do? He said, "They move down the street or a couple of blocks over and start up the same thing again." And that's what drove him out of the mattress business in L.A. Honest people trying to compete with dishonest people. With hardly a single exception, there is not a Jew firm, large or small, in the tobacco and cigar trades that has not, at some time in its career, made a failure, paying more or less inconsiderable amounts on the dollar. This is a statement which can readily be verified, and at the expenditure of very little trouble. The past history of the Jew houses in this respect is in marked contrast to the records of Aryan houses in the trade, among which latter there have been notable few failures. The saddest and most sickening spectacle in the cigar trade is that the present presented by the tenement house manufacturer, scattered throughout New York City in the most abject quarters, are tenement houses given over to families who earn a miserable livelihood by the making of cigars. In many instances, the whole family works at the manufacture, father, mother, and even the little children. The houses and floors occupied by these tenement cigar makers are rented for them by the Jews, who charge relatively exorbitant prices and pay the most scanty wages, and usually also own the butcher shop and the grocery store in the immediate vicinity of the tenement. So it's like a company store run by the Jews. The tenement house cigar maker is, to all intents and purposes, the Jew's slave. He's practically held in Israel's bondage. He starts out in the Jew's debt, and what with scanty wages and high prices charged at the butcher shop and grocery store, the Jew takes care that he never gets out. The unfortunate slave of the Jew is in 9 cases out of 10 compelled to buy the week's provision on credit. And by the time his wages have been earned, they have already been eaten up, have gone back into the Jew's pocket. And thus, month after month, year after year, he goes on toiling from early morning until late at night in the pestilence atmosphere of the tenement cigar factory, never making any progress, never gaining any headway, sweating out his life and the lives of his wife and his little ones in the service of the Jew. But are the Jews the sole maintainers of this system of degradation and misery? Solely and entirely. Every tenement cigar factory in New York City, large and small, without one solitary exception, is owned and carried on by Jews. We make this statement boldly and sweepingly, and we challenge contradiction. the number of tenement cigar makers, male and female, in New York City is about 10,000. It is next to impossible to ascertain how much, or more accurately speaking, how little is earned per capita by these tenement workers. For the Jew credits all of the cigars made in each tenement factory, or cheap floor, as it is now called, to the head of the household, regardless of how many other members of the family may be working at the trade. The earnings of a whole family are thus made to appear on the books as earnings of one person, and the tenement worker's figures on the paper as earning wages which he is very far indeed from receiving. This is a Jew trick, a ruse devised by Jew cunning and duplicity, the object in view being to effect a favorable showing in the event of the legislative or newspaper investigation. The squalor, misery, and dirt existing in these tenement cigar factories and the evils arising from the system in general have again and again been described by the newspapers of the metropolitan. Mrs. Helen Campbell some time ago gave a vivid description in the columns of the New York Tribune of the horrors to be encountered in these tenement factories, and the article was reproduced in that enterprising journal of the trade called Tobacco. The following facts are taken from her article. Imagine a room 12 by 14 feet overcrowded with busy workers and filled with poisonous atmosphere. Tobacco lay in piles upon the floor. Under long tables where the cigars were rolled, its rank smell dominating the stenches arising from the sink and from the general filth, not only of this room, but of the house as a whole. Two of the children sat on the floor stripping the leaves, and another on a stool. A girl of 20 sat near them, and all alike have sores on lips and cheeks and hands. Children from 5 to 6 years old can be taught to strip and thus add to the week's income, which is far less in the tenement house factory than in a regular factory, in which latter from $8 to $12 per week is averaged. But the work, if done at home, can be made to include the whole family, and some 4,000 women are engaged in the tenement cigar factories in New York, an almost equal but unregistered number of young children sharing the work with them. A number of women often club together using one room, and in such cases their babies crawl about in the filth of the wet floors, playing with the damp tobacco, and breathing the poison with which the room is saturated. Women and girls of every age became the victims of nervous and hysterical complaints, the direct result of nicotine poisoning, and succeeding these come throat diseases and consumption, which result in many instances from the dust. Canker is one of the most frequent afflictions, and sores of many orders. It is the children who suffer most, growth being stunted and nervous diseases developing, which end often in St. Vitus dance. Skin diseases of every variety are endangered. The causes being not only tobacco, but the filth in which these people live. Now remember, most of these people are white people. We're talking about white people when I'm reading this book. I'm not talking about just a bunch of niggers. These are white people. It is doubtful if the most inveterate smoker would feel much relish for the cigar manufactured under such conditions. Well, this is just like sending all the manufacturing over to China and Vietnam and so forth, and paying them pennies on the dollar, and squalid conditions and plants that burn down and burn up people and the whole bit. Yet hundreds of thousands of such cigars go out yearly from these tenements, bearing in every leaf the poison of their preparation. In these tenement factories, children under 10 years of age are to be found working as strippers and doing a day's work of 10 hours and more. The factory child fares far, far better than does the child of the cigar tenement, for in the factory there is an exercise and the going to and from work, while in the tenement factory the worn-out little creatures crawl to the bed, which is often only a pile of rags in the corner, or lie down on a heap of tobacco, breathing its poison day and night, uninterruptedly. Vices of every order flourish in such air, and morality in this trade is at its lowest ebb. Nervous excitement is so intense that necessarily nothing but immortality can result, and the child of 8 or 10 is well nigh as gross and confirmed as an offender as the grown man or woman. Now, you see, all these Jew congressmen and senators and big shots today in the film industry and so forth, their money comes from this kind of operation. All of that money they have built their careers on. And they'll say, oh, well, I didn't have anything to do with it. My family, my immediate family didn't. But if you go back, you'll find it's all built on this kind of operation. And the same with drugs, regular drugs. Disease may very readily be conveyed to the smoker through the tip of a cigar manufactured by the sore-lipped and sore-fingered workers in these uncleanly Jew tenement factories. The tip of the cigar is the very part which is the most difficult to roll. And 4 requires the most manipulation. Again, many of these cleanly workers, not under rigid supervision that is exercised in every first-class cigar factory, will often apply the tip of the cigar to their poison-laden lips to moisten the leaf, with a view to saving the time which would be spent in using a water brush or the implement which the gum tragacanth is applied. In this way, disease may be transmitted to the smoker. Not long ago, the Honorable M.J.B. Messimer, a coroner of the city and the county of New York, held an autopsy over the body of a man in the morgue who had committed suicide in consequence of his having been foully poisoned by a cigar made by some uncleanly workman. The publicity given to this case brought other cases of poisoning to light, and such was the scare created at the time that the greatest house in the trade, catering to the public demand, introduced a cigar with a patent wood tip, which obviated the necessity of the end of the cigar being manipulated, and affording a positive guarantee that portion which went into the smoker's mouth was wholesomely clean. You know, there's a couple of manufacturers even today that use those wood tips, and I used to wonder exactly why, but this obviously evolved from these problems they had. These wooden tip cigars sprang at a leap into the popular favor, and millions of them have been sold. They are still in the market. But the Jew, indifferent to the filth and misery and suffering in the tenements, heedless of the danger to the general public, goes on maintaining the iniquitous tenement manufacturing system. What cares he if a few thousand children go down to their graves in his service every year? What care if he if a few hundred Gentiles or Aryans are poisoned by his vile cigars? As long as he can manufacture cheaply and thereby accumulate money more rapidly, what cares he indeed? With the Jew lies the responsibility, With the Jew lies the responsibility of continuance of a present unjust and ridiculous internal revenue laws related to the manufacture of cigars. According to the law as it now stands, a bond of $500 must be furnished for every workman engaged in making cigars. The effect of this law is naturally to impede the workman in branching out on a small scale for himself. For if he starts in to manufacture on his own account without furnishing the bond and is detected, the penalties which he incurs are most severe. They involve the seizing and forfeiture of all the stock of the transgressor, of all his implements and fixtures, and if he own it, of his place of manufacture and the ground upon which it stands. It will thus be perceived that little is left to the man caught manufacturing cigars without the required Jewish legal bond, save his life. again and again, having the few great Aryan manufacturers in the trade urge that in justice to the workmen, these ridiculous laws should be repealed. But opposed to any such a repeal has been the solid Jew influence, and it has prevailed. The Jew will give the workman no chance to branch out in ever so small methods. Come on. He wants to keep the workman as a toiler in the tenement house or a wage slave in the factory, fettered and chained. But the Aryan manufacturer has reason to remember that the Jew, in other connection besides that of a competitor, is caused to remember him from his journalistic exploits in the trade newspaper line. A certain hook-nosed, black-muzzled Jew who started out as a peddler of bad cigars has obtained control of the trade newspaper, alleged to be devoted to the interests of the tobacco trade. This sheet is simply and solely a medium of blackmail, so cunning, unscrupulous, and audacious is its Jew owner that the whole trade stands in fear and trembling of him. Nothing is sacred to him. In one instance, he had attempted to blackmail a certain manufacturer a number of times, but always unsuccessfully. One fine day, the manufacturer got married to an estimable young lady. Then the Jew editor saw an opportunity for either blackmail or revenge, possibly both. He published a scandalous article reflecting on the lady's chastity prior to her marriage. The article was so cunningly devised that while dealing out its full weight of injury and venom, the Jew scoundrel was enabled to escape legal consequences and to avoid punishment in any form. A prominent house doing a large cigar trade has recently had cause grievously to regret having taken a Jew into its employ and having placed him in a position of trust. This house engaged a Jew as a buyer of its cigar supply. The Jew had not a dollar when he entered the service of the firm in question. In a couple of years, he owned two fast trotters, flaunting a showy mistress, and had a bank account amounting to $30,000. Finally, the firm scented something was wrong, and investigation ensued. Inquiry developed that the Jew buyer had been purchasing large stocks of inferior goods from the tenement house manufacturers of his own race, receiving, of course, a liberal commission upon the orders given in this direction. The goods were not only vile in quality, but were purchased at a cost hugely in excess of their rightful value. It was a case of a Jew playing into the hands of the Jews for mutual benefit and with regard to revenue only. The Jew trader was, of course, promptly kicked out as soon as his perfidy was detected, but nothing could be done in a legal way to punish him according to his deserts. He had managed too cleverly for that. The firm's reputation suffered largely through the operations of the Jew swindler to whom it had entrusted its affairs. One prudent customer of the firm closed his account with the house and refrained from having any further dealings with it. As soon as he learned that a Jew was at the head of the cigar department, the sequel proved how sagacious was his action. "I dare say it's all right," he said at the time, "but I make a point of never having any dealings with a man with Jew blood in his veins. Far-seeing merchant, wise man, let every prudent person follow this example." And that's the end of chapter five. And we'll continue this because it's very interesting, and it was written at a time where they were really going to expose these damn Jews, and that would have been the beginning of the last century, the end of the 1800s. But of course, the Jewish crimes go way back, long before that, of course. I'll be back with you tomorrow, Saturn's Day. In the meantime, remember 14:5 and watch out for them Jews.
I do. You're ripping me off, and I didn't deserve it because I didn't do nothing wrong. Your bum's sitting on my floor, brother. Don't fuck get someone in the 40 miles or whatever it is. I never saw the sign. I saw it 55, and I was doing 57. That's all I know. Now, just give me the damn thing, and I'll look at the day that I'm working. I'll pay the fine because I can't afford to take a day off. And if I'm not working, I'll plead not guilty because I know well I'm not guilty. There. Now, are you a state or local? Looks like you're a state trooper. Get back to pick up some more guys and run up the deficit on the working man. Just give me the damn thing. Let me get out of here.
What I need you to do is sign the X so I can explain this to you.
There ain't no explaining. I got picked up for speeding before. You're guilty and you paid the fine and hope your insurance don't.
Is that guy a Jew or isn't he? Sure as hell sounds like a Jew to me. Once in a while, I'm on the cop's side.